Hello and welcome to the Convex Conversation with me, journalist Helen Fosbarrow. Today I'm in an absolutely beautiful spot in the heart of Cumbria to meet this week's guest who has truly lived life on the edge. Sir Chris Bonington is without doubt Britain's most well-known climber, much loved and revered. He conquered Everest the hard way, in fact led some of the most important ascents in the Himalayas, and made the first British ascent of the north face of the Eiger. And at the age of 80, he returned to the summit of the Old Man of Hoy. No mean feat. Chris, thank you so much for inviting me to your beautiful garden. We can hear the birdsong in the background, but I just want you to describe where we are, because the scenery here is absolutely breathtaking.
It's on the very northwest corner of the Lake District, so it's on the very edge of the Lakeland Hills. I think the lakes are every bit as beautiful as anywhere in the world, and they're unique as well, because they're a tiny area. They're about 40 miles across in each way, kind of. So it's a small area of mountains, and it's rather like, it's like the spokes of a wheel. So you've got from the central core of the lakes, you've got these valleys and ridges stretching out, and each valley has its own special individual character, be it Ennerdale, Borrowdale, Buttermere, and so on. And each one is specially beautiful in its own kind of way. And so I think there's nowhere that I know that is both so beautiful and so tremendously accessible. And it's not rugged mountains, it's just a rolling, lovely hill. And over the years, I've just walked all of them and loved them dearly.
And you've been lucky enough to be here throughout the coronavirus lockdown. What do you make of the virus, Chris?
Well, the whole world and the whole of Europe is actually completely laid low by this virus. And not only that, it's been a kind of an amazing, frightening kind of wake-up call about, can we go on doing this? It's almost as if nature is telling us that this is no longer sustainable. But of course, the frightening thing is that the virus has died down, I think the changes it's made, both economically and everything else, will be a very different kind of world when we come out of it. But that does go away as well. But the real deep problem is global warming. And that's not going to go away. It's going to get worse and worse unless we do something about it. And just maybe and hopefully some of the lessons we're learning going through the coronavirus, suddenly there's not so many planes in the sky, there's not so many cars on the road, is to actually say, well, yes, we can start doing something about finishing global warming. But that needs a world effort. It needs the countries, well, countries like the United States and Brazil, China, to actually say we've got to take dramatic, painful changes to actually stop global warming. And I think we can do it, but the time frame is terribly tight.
How close to the edge in terms of climate change do you think we really are?
I think we're incredibly close. I think there's inevitably the experts, there's a whole series of different opinions, but I think the scientific community definitely reckon that we're very, very close to the tipping point where we can't slow down climate change. But you can only do that slowdown if the major states of the world actually come together to change it. That means the United States, Brazil, China, India, all realising and making the very big sacrifices that are going to be needed to actually stop or slow down global warming. But it's something that we must do for our children, our children's children.
I've been looking over the last few days at some beautiful photographs in your book Ascent. I'm thinking your grandfather Maximilian in the Andaman Islands and your father on walkabout in Australia. Would it be fair to say, Chris, that adventuring and exploring is part of your DNA?
I think it probably is. I mean, I actually, when I wrote Ascent, I did ponder about the kind of experiences you have in life and what you were born with and what are in your genes. And I think that what you're born with in your genes is really going to be the strongest determinator in the kind of course of life that you're going to have. I mean, we all have, we have our bad times and our good times, and it's a matter of actually being able to work and how we've worked through those. And I think when I look at what my grandparents and great-grandparents did on both sides of the family, and they were amazing people that did some amazingly adventurous things. And I think I've had the fortune of actually inheriting some of those traits.
And it started when you were young. I mean, when you were three, you wandered off from the garden on your own to Hampstead Heath.
I was brought up in Hampstead until really the beginning of the war, the Second World War. And we were living in Tanzer Road, which is actually backing on Parliament Hill. We had a downstairs flat. My mum never owned a house, she was always renting. And there was a gate out onto Hampstead Heath. And so with this little girlfriend of mine, we got out into the wilds and went walkabout. And we were finally found by, I think, my grandma, when she realised we'd gone, my mum was out at work, and my grandma really looked after me while I was young. My mum was a single parent. And I think it was the police who finally found us and took us back to the Belsize Park police station. And where I think I showed a certain character as well, because it was unwise enough to put us in the office of the inspector in the police station and left us alone. And I got his fridge open, and there was a bottle of milk. And I got it out, not to drink it, but to pour it all over his desk. And I think they were very, very glad to get rid of us when my nan finally came and picked us up.
Oh, Mum and Nan really raised you, didn't they? What were your sort of abiding memories of growing up in that sort of female environment?
Even that was quite confusing, in the sense that my mum fell out with my nan. I think it was partly because my nan had brought me up. She had brought me up as a baby. And my mum as well discovered, in fact, that she was gay. And I think all of those things, my mum was a fabulous mum. There's no doubt about that. But I think I only even really began to realise how special she was many, many years later, particularly when I started writing my own full autobiography, and I started reading her letters and her diaries, which I'd inherited. And I think that kind of unusual background I benefited from, I think, in many different kinds of ways. I've got no prejudices, and I think I've always accepted people as they are. And I think even in leading my expeditions, when I was leading big expeditions, I believed in, as a leader, you have to make hard decisions, but you also have to gain the respect of the people who are actually working with you.
And your first big adventure was when you were 16 with your pal Anton. Tell us about that, Chris.
I'd seen the hills of Snowdon from a distance. My grandfather, my paternal grandfather, had retired to Dublin, and I'd go and stay with him in the holidays. And coming back, you saw the distant hills of Snowdon. So I thought it'd be great to go and climb Snowdon. And we chose the hardest winter for many years in 1951, persuaded Anton to come with me. And it's amazing that my mum and his parents allowed us to do it. And we hadn't got a clue. I persuaded my mum to cut down my school map to make it look like an anorak, and I bought a pair of hobnail boots. And Anton just had his school shoes and a school mac. And we hitchhiked all the way up to Snowdonia and then set off to climb Snowdon. It was covered in snow, gently snowing, and we very nearly turned back at the very beginning. And then there were a couple of guys in the car park who obviously were climbers. They had ropes and everything. And so we'll follow them. We got about halfway up Snowdon and we were avalanched. And it was a really good avalanche. We were swept down about 400 or 500 feet, survived that, and The two experts turned back, so we did as well. And we were staying in the youth hostel at Capo Keurig. And then Anton, the next day, he hitchhiked all the way back to London, never to go into the hills again. And I was absolutely hooked. It had been brilliant. And I stayed on, and the youth hostel was full. So I went and stayed in a little B&B. And there were another couple of guys who were climbers staying in the same B&B. And I was very shy at that time, so in the youth hostel, and they were talking about climbing. And I didn't know that climbing existed as a sport. But I knew as they described it that this was something I had to do. And then I found a friend of the family who'd done a bit. And that's how I first started climbing.
You've described that climb, I think, as giving you a sense of enchanted elation. I love those words, and I wonder sort of what you mean by that and what it was that really drew you into the world that's come to define you. What was it about the magic of the mountains that made you realise that was where you wanted to be?
Yeah, mountains move me. A natural, wild beauty moves me intensely and always has done. But then once I started climbing, and that was what really got me, and the climbing was the physical process of it, I found a physical thing that I was just naturally good at. And it's also the element of risk in climbing that is the, you know, is the spice of it. And the fact that you know, if you let go, you could die. And certainly in the early days when basically the climbing equipment we had in those days was absolutely basic, and my knowledge, I never went on a climbing course, was all kind of self-taught, with a combination of actually being incredibly lucky to fall in with various very important mentors on the way through. But I discovered something that I passionately loved. And I still do. I mean, climbing is limited because when I did climb the O'Malley Foy when I was 80, I did actually do myself quite damage as well because my back was very strained. Wendy, my deceased wife, had been extremely ill with motor neuron disease, and I'd been heaving her around and everything else, so that I was in a weak state at that stage. And then Leo Holding, great climbing friend of mine, said, well, why don't you come and do the O'Malley Foy to celebrate reaching the age of 80? And I think he did it as well to get as a way of getting me out of the grief of having lost Wendy. Still find it hard to talk about. But so we went off and we did it. And I actually, I think I pulled two discs in the process of doing the O'Malley Foy. I just probably very unwisely climbed through the pain. And so got to the top, had two slip discs, and then had a whole, ended up with back surgery, this, that, and the other. And all of that, I think I have actually damaged probably some nerves that have affected my balance. So my balance is awful. So I think my climbing days are over, but I can actually go on climbing walls because I'm great going up and down, straight up. But I still love walking. I still love being in the hills as passionately as I ever have done. And I still actually, I'm a great believer in living in the present and making the absolute most of the present. And looking into the future, looking back at the past, I think it's good to look back at the past, realise some of the mistakes you made, but also actually enjoy that kind of the core of your life that was in that past. But it's what goes on today and what takes you into tomorrow that really drives me, and that's what drives me now and still does.
I agree with you. I think the today is very important, and I think the dipping into the past for our listeners and for somebody like me today is hearing about some of those wonderful adventures and the achievements and what it was like, because most of us can't imagine what it's like to be on the summit of Everest or the north face of the Eiger. And I'm just wondering, was it in the Alps that you really cut your teeth on climbing, when you were in the Royal Tank Regiment? Is that when you got to grips with the actual climbing of mountaineering?
when I started climbing in 1951, the effects of the Second World War were still very much there. There was still a limit on travelling abroad, a limit to the amount of money you could take abroad and everything else. And much more to the point with me, my mum, I suppose, well, having been a single parent, most of her money went on my education. And so that there's no question of going abroad at all. So all my climbing initially was, I didn't even think particularly initially of distant Alps. My focus was actually doing the climbing I could reach. So it was in the summer holidays, I'd hitchhike up to Scotland, to the Highlands, find odd people to climb with and get into all kinds of adventures. And that was my horizon then. And then it was only when I was end up going to Sandhurst, the Royal Military Academy, and went into the Royal Tank Regiment. And the first time I'd ever been abroad was when I was stationed in North Germany in the 2nd Royal Tanks in Munster, Westphalia. Suddenly, I could catch a train down to the Alps, and I immediately phoned or wrote to a climbing friend of mine who's actually much more experienced than I, but I'd done some good climbs with him in Scotland, and said, any chance of climbing together in the Alps? And Hamish McInnes, who's one of the great characters of British Scottish mountaineering, I said, yes, sure, he'd love to climb with me. And I think Hamish, we had climbed together, and once again, he'd taken me up a couple of climbs in the winter in Glencoe. And so I then met him in Grindelwald, and he said that we should go for the north wall of the Eiger, which I have, you know, your introduction to alpinism. And I met Hamish there. We went to the foot of the Eiger and we started up it. Perhaps it was just as well. The weather was very bad and we turned back. But I remember the first night we were bivouacked, and the standard thing on the Eiger is you bivouac in those days. You bivouac at the foot of the real difficulties. It's about 1,500 feet of scrambling up. And I'll never forget, I was at this stage realising I was way in over my head. How the hell do I get out of this? And there were some clouds building up in the west, and it was a clear sign of a front coming in. And I said, look, Hamish, I think there's a front coming in. I think we should go down now because the weather's going to break. And Hamish, well, I didn't even give him any choice. I just packed my rucksack, put on my head torch, and Hamish followed. Now, if that hadn't happened and we'd gone on, and I think if the weather had been good, we'd have climbed it. Hamish had the experience and the knowledge to get us up it, and I probably was technically very, very good, much stronger as a climber than Hamish was.
You worked briefly as a management trainee for Unilever. Did the defining moment come during that period where you realised that you had to make up your mind, you know, what you were going to do career-wise and whether mountaineering could be a full-time job for you?
I never imagined that I could make a living as a climber. So, I mean, when I was in Germany with my regiment, there was a local ad for the Army Outward Bound School in Wales. And I decided, oh, gosh, get back to Wales, get back to climbing and everything else. So I applied, and my colonel said that was a very, very bad career move. But I wasn't that worried about that. But it was at the Army Outward Bound School that I discovered that I'm definitely not a teacher. I'm not a guide. I like climbing absolutely to the limit. And so that I therefore was cutting off really a career as a guide, which I could have easily have had if I'd been happy in that Army Outward Bound School kind of situation. I knew as well that I didn't want to go back to my regiment and go on with the army. So at that stage, I thought, well, I'll just try to get a job in Civvy Street in London and just become a weekend climber. And I applied to all the companies, and it was Unilever that actually offered me a role as a management trainee, with Vandenberg selling margarine. And so and I very quickly discovered that that definitely was not my scene either. And then I was invited on another expedition. It was an expedition to Patagonia in 1963. And at that point, I took the plunge. But even then, I thought, well, maybe we'll go to Patagonia and then maybe I'll try to get to university and maybe get a degree and become a teacher or something like that so I could get lots of climbing. I couldn't imagine doing what I did. And the way that happened was that, of course, when I had what was going to be my last long holiday before I started trying to do all these things, and I climbed the North Wall and made the first British ascent to the North Wall of the Eiger, and suddenly, because of that, and it really caught the imagination of the press. I mean, it was headlines in every single paper in Britain, and it was partly, once again, because there'd been... we'd been involved in some rescues on the Eiger and this, that and the other. But suddenly I was asked to write a book, I was asked to give lectures, and really from there I really built up the kind of life that I've led, which is basically being a communicator. I write and lecture and describe what I've done, and I enjoy the challenge of actually trying to tell the non-climber, the ordinary reader, and try to transfer to them the joy, the excitement, the thrills and everything that I've had. And that's my job. And the fun bit and recreation is still when I can get off climbing.
And that's where I'd like you to take me, if you would. Can you take me to that trip, the North Wall of the Eiger, when you made the first British ascent, and try and paint a picture for me, try and transport me there to the sort of conditions you faced and what it was like and that sense of euphoria when you made it?
Well, I'd spent two summers before that actually trying to climb the North Wall of the Eiger, initially with Don Willans, who, one of the finest climbers that Britain's ever produced. He and Joe Brown basically fronted a revolution of working-class climbers. Suddenly, kind of with the Second World War, there was the five-day week, there was weekends, young working-class lads around the Peak District had that little bit more time, and they were able to get out onto the crags. And there were a lot of them, and they were practical, physical, and they revolutionised British climbing. And these two were at the forefront. So it was really with Don first, and we'd had several attempts on it, gone through various epics. And in that summer of 1962, Don and I, we'd made one attempt. We'd rescued this guy, Brian Nally, off the Eiger, and then had gone off to enjoy the rest of the holiday. I'd just got married, and so Wendy and Don's wife, Audrey, they'd hitchhiked out. We, at that time, we had Don's motorbike, so we could get around on the motorbike. And we went off to the Austrian Alps. And then at the end of that, the holiday was nearly over. We knew we were going to Patagonia together in late October. And Don had, I forget what it was, he had something that he had to get back to. And Don, once he'd made up his mind about something, he just did it. Whereas I've always been very flexible. I change my mind regularly. And the weather was perfect. So I said, well, Don, well, you go back and I'll stick around for a bit. And Ian Clough, with whom we'd climbed the Central Pillar of Frenny the previous year, was around. And so the two of us were there. And the weather was good. So I thought, well, I'll just get a couple of climbs in. I hadn't thought of the North Wall of the Eiger at this stage. And we went and did a superb climb. We did the North Wall of the Grand Jurasse, which is one of the great alpine kind of routes. But then, when we got to the top, we'd climbed it very, very fast. We're both on the peak of our form, age and everything. And so I said, look, let's bivouac on top, and tomorrow we'll do this huge traverse of the Jurasse and the Rochefort Ridge all the way back to the Torino Hut. And then maybe after that, we could go on and climb Mont Blanc. And so we did all that. And then that night when we got there, and I suddenly realised the Eiger must be in perfect condition. And I woke up, I think we were in bunk beds, and Ian was on the top bunk. I kept pushing, Ian, you know, I've got a brilliant idea. I said, let's go for the Eiger. And he goes, oh, fuck off. I restrained myself until the morning and said, you know, it's a serious possibility. And Ian agreed. So that's how the two of us got onto it. And then it was after all the kind of false starts, bad weather and everything. And then when we went for it this time, it was just perfect. The weather was perfect, it was settled, the conditions were very, very good as well. And we climbed it, and it was, we just raced up it, but in a very leisured, relaxed kind of way, even to the degree that we bivouacked in lowish down for a start, and then we got and we crossed the second ice field and we went on up and got into the upper part, and we bivouacked again. There was a bit of stone fall coming in the upper part, so we bivouacked on the Travels of the Gods, which is just kind of near, quite near the top, and then had a wonderful bivouac, and you know, completely relaxed. We knew the weather was settled, it was freezing hard that night, so no stones would be coming down the next morning. And the view you have on a mountain like that, and you're looking, the north wall of the Eiger is on the very edge of the Alps, and so you're looking across lower hills and you're looking to the west, and it's a huge kind of stretching horizon. And then the next morning we set out, and once again there was kind of went straight through the White Spider. And then I made a route-finding mistake in the upper part. It was almost, we were looking for difficulty and we found it so easy. And so we start out what could have been a direct finish to the north wall of the Eiger. But I then realised our mistake, so we abseiled back down and then carried on. And at that point, we took the rope off and soloed up to the top of the north wall of the Eiger. So when we finally climbed it, it was just a glorious, wonderful route. Oh, and even there, tragically, there was a couple of young guys, a British climber and an Austrian climber, who were also going for the Eiger. And we'd seen them below us. They were going much slower than us. And while we had raced up to the top in perfect conditions, they'd been that little bit too slow. So in the middle of the lower part of the face, when the sun hits the upper part and the stones start coming down, and they're swept to their death. And in a way, all of that, tragically, yeah, made it even bigger news. But as far as I was concerned, it was just a wonderful climb. And it was a wonderful day's climbing.
You've been in brutal conditions, though, too, haven't you, on the Eiger? I'm thinking 1966. I think it was your first assignment as a photojournalist for the Daily Telegraph magazine. Things were difficult. That was the north face of the Eiger, wasn't it, when John Harlan lost his life?
Well, that was an interesting one, because it was when I'd now, in 1966, I'd been in the lakes now for 3 years, making a living around climbing. And I was lecturing very modestly in those days. They were mainly ladies' luncheon clubs, and you got between £10 and £20 per lecture. And then a really good one was down in Plymouth with the Royal Navy, and you had a week of lecturing young naval recruits, and it was £2 a lecture. But you'd do three a day. And you'd lecture to these recruits, who of course were all fast asleep, because that's how I'd been making a living up to that time. And I was just beginning to get some work as well with the colour magazines. And it was John Anstey, who was the editor of the Daily Telegraph magazine, and I submitted some pictures to him, which he'd liked. And then when this team were attempting this Eiger direct route, they sent me out, not to be a climber, but to be a photographer. And all originally I was going to do was photographing them at the start and then meeting at the top and photographing at the finish. And then it developed, and the climbers, the British climbers, Dougal Haston, Leighton Kaur, who's a brilliant American climber, and John Harlan, who was a charismatic American mountaineer based on Switzerland. And so then, though, it developed into a race because a German team arrived, all 12 of them, who were going to lay siege to the north wall of the Eiger. It had never been climbed in winter at this stage. And therefore, my little team had no choice. They were going to have to actually join the siege game, which meant fixing ropes and everything, which meant just the three of them were very weak on. It also meant that I, as the photographer, could now get much higher up the face. So I then went up and was photographing them as well as they did the climb. And it was intriguing, and it was kind of pure, absolute theatre, because the face is just opposite Kleine Scheidegg, which is this famous hotel, and you can see the face from Kleine Scheidegg and the people climbing on it and everything else. And so you get all the people looking through their telescopes at the climbers. And we go back, and we were actually staying at the Kleine Scheidegg Hotel as well, so quite considerable comfort. Finally, though, the big push was going to take place. And at this stage, I'd got involved in the climbing. And so I led one of the hardest ice pitches on the climb, because I was climbing with Leighton Kaur, who was a brilliant rock climber. And Dougal and Harlan had gone back, the weather had been bad, so they'd gone back to Les Ains to see their families. And there was a break in the weather. I led the critical pitch, in fact, that got us through. We then came back. And I was very happy. I was still in photographer mode. And so I had no desire to finish the climb off. What I wanted to do was get down to the bottom, go up to the top with someone, run a long line of rope down it so I could get really good shots of them as they finished the climb. And then, of course, John Harlan was killed. And there was an accident waiting to happen. We were climbing using fixed ropes, much too thin, dynamic rope, which kind of stretches, it's climbing rope. And inevitably, one of the ropes frayed and he fell to his death. And at that point, so it developed then into not a rescue. They fought their way through, and Dougal Caston and three of the Germans managed to survive and get to the top. But it was it was melodrama in every kind of way, and theatre. And in actual fact, it was fun.
And the mountains, Chris, can be cruel, can't they? I mean, tell us about some of the times when you've lost dramatic amounts of weight in the mountains, or the conditions have been freezing and you've suffered frostbite. Can you give us that kind of sense of what you go through sometimes? You made the north wall of the Eiger sound like a walk in the park, but there are tough conditions out there, aren't there?
Well, I think, yes. I mean, you come through every kind of condition, every kind of adventure, And so I suppose the worst for me was on the Eiger, which we made the first ascent of. And there, everything went smoothly until we got to the very top of the mountain, and as Doug Scott and I actually made it to the top. And it was a complex, very, very complex mountain. And we got to the top just as it was getting dark. And then Doug, in the first abseil, he'd taken his crampons off. He'd led this incredibly difficult wall of rock just below the summit. And he, with his crampons off, he stood on some ice and he fell. It was a big pendulum swing and broke both legs. So we now have a guy with two broken legs on top of the Eiger. Two members of the original team had now gone down. They were back at base camp, and there were just four of us. And somehow we got down, and it was we ran out of food. It was a real struggle. And yet you just get involved. You know, you just focus in and get it done, basically. I think there's the experience to yourself in climbing, however extreme those experiences are, they're all part of the game. It's not masochistic. You actually make yourself as comfortable as you possibly can in any circumstance. And you become very good at, you know, making the best of really bad circumstances. And that's what climbing's all about. It doesn't wound you. And I think I've lost all too much. I've lost what on 4 of my major expeditions. I mean, I've lost close friends. And yet, once again, I feel sadness at their loss. There are friends that I valued greatly. But I think it was a little bit like, I suppose, in a wartime situation where, once again, you know, you're in a dangerous situation and you lose the people around you to whom you've come very close. But you've all chosen, particularly in a climber's case, you've all chosen to be in that situation. You've gone into it with your eyes open. How you justify that with your responsibility to the woman you love at home, to your children, who at least, you know, I mean, in my case, Wendy knew what she was getting into when she married me. But our children didn't. And yet, I'm afraid, once again, I think your passion for the thing you love doing so much, and yeah, it is a selfish passion, is so great that you couldn't live without it.
Did you ever have a moment on the mountain where you thought, this is it, my sort of, my luck or my skill with this has run out? Did you ever have a close shave where you feel blessed that you came back down in one piece?
Oh my God, I've about at least a dozen times. I mean, I'm not, some of my climbing mates who've sadly lost their lives are incredibly careful climbers, very, very thorough, calculate their risks very carefully. I don't think I ever have done, and I'm slightly careless. And so that, you know, I've made loads of mistakes, and I suppose the worst of the lot was with my brother. Gerald is his half-brother and a lot younger than me, 17 years younger than I am. So I first met Gerald when he was 5 and seen him grow up. And he's one of my closest friends. But Gerald and I had gone climbing in Scotland on Loch na Garr, which is on the Queen's Estate. I'd led out the top pitch, which is it's quite straightforward kind of mixed ice and rock climbing. And I'd just put in one running belay, which you have a little metal wedge and you jam it in a crack, put a carabiner through. So I got this one running belay, then ran the full rope out, and you're heading for a kind of bay of snow, and then you can get a belay. And the trouble is, it was just deep snow. There was nowhere where you could actually hammer in a piton or get in a solid thing. So I just cut out, and I just cut out a kind of slash in the snow to stand on, buried my 2 axe points, tied off on them, and started bringing Gerald up, who was 45 metres below me. And he was a big guy, and the start of this was a bit awkward, and he fell off. And for me, it was like a catapult, because the ropes kind of, you know, has stretch in it. And I was just pulling, I mean, my belays were totally, utterly inadequate. And so I just shot down. Now, at that point, I thought, this is it. And so I'm going hurtling down. And what was good was the sheer violence of the pull pulled me right out. So I didn't hit anything on the way down. So I was going head first. I could see right the way down to the bottom. I knew it was there. There's no way we were going to survive that. And then suddenly it stopped. And that one little nut had held. And where I was lucky as well, though, was that I'd hit the snow of the bay. That, so poor Jerry, he couldn't understand what was happening, because when you're the second, you know, you're entitled to think you're completely safe because the ropes cut there. And he couldn't understand why. He was whizzing down as well and hadn't been held. So then he stopped just below me. I'd stopped there, and I think I'd hit the snow just before the weight had come on that one carabiner, so that it held. And then we managed to climb out.
You must have given him a hell of a fright. I mean, he's still speaking to you now, isn't he? He lives down the road.
Oh, Gerald's very cool and calm. But we weren't going to tell our respective wives anything at all about that. And inevitably, it got out. Well, apart from that, there were two people just behind us, so they'd seen it. And so we had to admit what happened. And then Rachel, Gerald's wife, and we were going off on a trip very shortly after that. It was a kind of a trekking come climbing trip in the Himalayas. And Rachel looked at me very hard and said, "Chris, do look after him. I couldn't live without him." And I thought, you know, gosh.
No pressure there then. You summited Everest. There's a fabulous picture of you in your book on the top of Everest. It was quite emotional, wasn't it, the progress that you made to the summit? I think you felt the presence of a fellow climbing friend.
Yeah, I hadn't realised. I'd almost put Everest out of my mind. I'd had, after even the southwest face of Everest, we'd attempted Everest with a very small team from the north side, and now I'd been involved in another trip to Everest as well. And then finally I decided, no, this, you know, that's it. I'm not going to go to Everest again. And then this Norwegian friend of mine, Arne Næss, who was a multimillionaire, but he was a climber. And he lived in London. And he'd actually come to ask my advice. He was planning, he wanted to finance and lead the first ever Norwegian Everest expedition. And he came up to see me, and we got on very well together, and we actually climbed together quite a bit after that. And then Arne asked me to actually come on to his Norwegian Everest expedition, which was going to attempt it by the South Col route, because of my basic kind of knowledge of logistics, so that I could, in effect, be his kind of chief of staff on the expedition and do all his logistics and planning and everything else. And that meant that I also had the chance of at last getting to the top of Everest just by the ordinary route. And it was also 1985 was the last year that the Nepalese government only allowed one expedition on the route at a time. And that meant that our Norwegian expedition, we had Everest to ourselves. And it's all very straightforward climbing. And I was the first attempt on the summit there. You go from the South Col straight to the top, as they do in these days. And we took a fixed rope up the Lhotse face. And the first attempt, they got to the top, but it was a very, very high wind, so they turned back. So suddenly, me with my two Norwegian friends, Odd and Bjorn, were now going to be the first ascent. And we had two Sherpas with us, and we were using the Sherpas not as they are now, as kind of rope fixers, but we were using the Sherpas to fix ropes as well as climb with us. So really, these were two climbers who would just like to get to the top. And one of them was Potemba, who was our chief Sherpa, or Sirdar, who'd been my Sirdar in 75, and a very good friend. And so the five of us did it. And it was, we soloed. I mean, we only used a rope once on the famous Hillary Step, and Bjorn led it. He was the best climber amongst us, but, you know, straightforward climbing. And then we just all went to the top and came back down. And it was a wonderful expedition, but I think in the final bit, there was kind of strong memories. And I think that wonderful, as we were just going up, basically, it was going up the fixed rope that Bjorn had left. I was really struggling. I was the oldest person at that time who tried to climb Everest. Young 50-year-old. Now I believe an 80-year-old has climbed it. But anyway, I was struggling up. And I had this absolute kind of hallucination, I suppose. And I had Doug Scott, who, you know, had been, he went to the top of Everest in 75, and he was floating beside me, and he was just quietly talking me up it. And he got me to the top of the Hillary Step, and then he vanished. And I think I knew that, you know, that wasn't done. That was something my mind had created, but it showed the strength of it. And then from the top of the Hillary Step to the top, I forget, it's 200 feet high. It's not very far to the top. And it's just a matter of plod, plod, plod. And I just couldn't help thinking of all the very close friends I had who'd lost their lives on Everest. Mick Burke, Peter Warman, Joe Tasker, and I was bloody tired too, and I just slumped into the snow and cried my eyes out, and then realised where I was. And it was a wonderful morning. It was 9:30 in the morning, and on the cloud in the sky, and you had this incredible vista of mountains around you. And I think the most amazing is when you look to the north and you're looking across the Tibetan plateau, and that's all brown. And then there's the occasional little white cap, which is a slightly higher peak that's covered in snow. And then looking to the east, you can see Kanchenjunga, third highest mountain in the world, 80 miles away, very clearly. Looking much closer, you're looking across to Makalu, an absolutely magnificent mountain in its own right. Or looking to the west, you're looking along the chain of the Himalayas towards Annapurna in the far distance. It was an amazingly powerful moment. And what's even more important, I think, it was a wonderful expedition. Norwegians, they're a great crowd. It was a very happy expedition. And I don't think there was any tension throughout that expedition either. So, no, it was very special.
Back at home, back in the Lake District, you've touched on Wendy, your wife of many, many, many years, until she sadly died in 2014. How did she cope raising a young family and with you away a lot? Was she really magnificent at that and very understanding that that was who you are and what you needed to do?
She was amazing, and she never put any kind of stay on what I was trying to do. If she sensed that I wasn't happy about it, in other words, that perhaps I was doing it for the wrong kind of reasons, in other words, that I was feeling that I had a duty either to our sponsor or this, that or the other, but felt I had to go on with it, even so. And she would detect that straight away. And she'd ask me some very hard questions. And every time she was right. So she's never said, don't do it. But she asked those questions which enabled me to realise that this was the wrong thing to do. She was a person of huge creative talent and ability.
I think when we arrived to speak to you today with Loretto, who you're married to, you said to me, it's a very lucky person who finds such a deep love twice in their life, isn't it? But you have found love again, and Wendy's memory, I'm sure, is very strong and very precious. But you've found happiness again with Loretto.
I found a deep, deep kind of love once again. And I wasn't looking so much at that time. There's no doubt about it. Friends of ours were pushing us together a bit. So we'd found ourselves very often sitting next door to each other at dinner parties and things. But still not, you know, never remote. I was almost frightened of Loretta. I mean, she's such an incredibly beautiful, vivacious woman. And in 2015, it was an Alpine Club dinner. I'd invited Loretta to come, and typical me, I'd got the dates wrong. But anyway, we got that right. And so she said, well, come and stay. And we caught the bus to the dinner, because the Alpine Club dinner is now quite informal. And we just sat talking non-stop with each other right the way through, and then got out, and we were waiting for the bus back. I kissed her,
and the rest is history. She melted.
The rest is history.
Oh, and now that you're not obviously off 6 months of the year climbing, I mean, your time is very precious, isn't it? You're out together, you walk together, you spend a lot of your days together.
We spend very, very few days apart, and I wouldn't want it any other way. You know, I suppose my drive is to, I owe her it, and I owe myself. You know, I want to keep mentally and physically moderately active for at least another 10, 15 years. Maybe asking a lot, but I'll go for it.
I don't think so at all. I mean, Chris, it strikes me you are absolutely making the most of every day and have no plans to slow down. And in fact, as instructed, I've got my hiking boots with me. So we're off over the garden wall, aren't we?
We are indeed, and depends how long you've got, we could do a lovely 6 kilometre walk.
Well, I'm going for 6 kilometres, so we'll go and get ourselves ready. You've been listening to Sir Chris Bonington, one of life's true gentlemen, talking about his adventures from his home in the Lake District. I'm off for an adventure of my own now, so do wish me luck. Thank you for listening to The Convex Conversation. Please do feel free to share Chris's story on socials. You'll find us on Spotify, Apple and Google Podcasts, as well as at convex.podbean.com. Bye for now.